at the ball valve. Air was leaking at the ball valve. So once I put this putty around the connection between the PVC and the ball valve, that stopped, the leaking stopped. But I still wanted to protect myself in case something was going to dislodge from the PVC, but it didn't. I went all the way up to 60 pounds of pressure, air pressure, and nothing happened. The launcher worked flawlessly, just flawlessly. Did exactly what I needed it to do, Paul. Go ahead.
W1WOR.
I hear another station. Great, Rich. I mean, great description. And, I can see putting a ball valve in between. And I'm not sure, did you use our PVC glue to attach the ball valve pipe? And I heard another station, so let me just unkeep.
Well, the PVC to PVC connections, I use primer and PVC glue. But in checking around on the internet, they said if you're attaching brass to PVC, get this other stuff. It's a white soft stuff that doesn't harden. I forget the name of it. You would probably know the name of it. But that didn't help too much in one of the connections. That's why I had to buy the putty. What's the name of it? I keep on thinking K-Tech, not K-Tech. I could look at what the name of this white stuff was that you're supposed to use if you're going copper to PVC. Go ahead.
There's a number of ways to do it, but, you know, you could always attach looks like a coupling, but it's really a threaded connection. You could glue that on one end of the PVC. Now you have a threaded connection, and then you could take a screw, a ball valve, and screw that into that. And, you know, you could do that on both sides. You'd be good to go. Number of ways of doing it. Anyway, it's a very creative way of doing it. All right, now you're going to put something in the one end. What is that something? Did you put a weight or something in the one end and shoot a fishing line up and then pull the wire up? Or just wondering how you did that. Back to you, Rick.
That's exactly what it is. It's a Arbor's throw bag or some such thing. It's an 8.7 ounce little bag, yellow bag, so it's easy to identify. I wanted to try this before the leaves came on the tree, in case, you know, the bag got lost somewhere up in the tree. But fortunately, the bag came almost all the way down to the ground. I have a string. I forgot what weight the string is, but it's a knot. It doesn't curl up on you. I attached that to the weight, and I needed a sabot. I don't know if you guys know what a sabot is. The bag still had too much room between itself and the edge of the piece PVC, so I stuffed it with a little paper towel so it would fit snugger as I'm, you know, and I pushed it down. I pushed it down the barrel with a golf club, but it didn't work too well until I put that extra paper towel in there to take up the space between the bag and the PVC. And so when I shot it up, out came the weight, but also out came all this string that was attached to the weight. And there's a technique to do that too, so it doesn't curl up. You put the string, you just crisscross it and put it in there like a bag, like a shopping bag. So it just lays flat, you know, as you're unrolling it off the reel. And so when it shoots out, it won't, you know, it'll come out, the string will come out straight and it won't catch on itself. So that's the way I did it. Like I said, if anybody wants to borrow it, it works perfectly. And they sell them for $300-$400.
That's great. That's great. And that air valve you put on there, they call that a Schrader valve. So you got that from somewhere. Probably the, you know, you probably get that at Walmart or the AutoZone or something in there. Yeah, very, very well done. Back to you, Rich.
WNWR.
Yeah?
Comment?
Sure.
Just a quick note on NFED half-wave. I know that term is used a lot, and there are some people, operators, do not understand exactly what it means. When it means half-wave, that means half-wave on a particular length of wire and frequency, usually mid-band. It depends. So you have to optimize it, okay, for, and you might need an auto-tuner, depends. You might want to optimize it for your, if you want to use a half-wave, you have to optimize it for that particular band. Back to you.
Okay, well, yeah, NFED antennas usually come in two flavors. One is a resonant form where the it's a half wavelength of the longest wavelength signal that you are want to work, want to transmit, want to receive. And then there is non-resonant or random NFED wires, which are absolutely positively not half wavelength long. And they have differing qualities and characteristics. The resonant half wave requires a much higher correcting balun transformer, you know, a 88, 67, what have you, to one versus a 9-to-1 that a non-resonant random NFED half wave, NFED that's not half wave.
Usually okay, for 40 on up, you use 66 feet of wire going into the transformer.
It depends what the lowest frequency operation you want to do, because it will perform reasonably well with the harmonics. So you have a starting frequency. If you cut it too short, then it's not going to get to whatever frequency. So it has to be a half wave approximately for the lowest frequency, longest wavelength signal you want to operate on.
66 foot is for 40 meters on up. One thing I could also say, I couldn't believe it, so I checked it twice with two different instruments, is my SWR at the bottom of each cycle of SWR, if you could call it that, is like 1.2, 1.4 to 1. So I was very happy about that. The NFED half wave that came down this winter didn't have anywhere near that. So now it's they're not exactly where I want them to be. The dips aren't exactly where I want them to be, but they're close enough that I'm just gonna. I'm not gonna cut the wire and maybe screw it up, because it almost fits perfectly into my apartment, ground floor apartment, from the tree. So that's the story.
You wouldn't change the length if the harmonics were a little bit off. You would insert a small inductor or capacitor to correct for that slight off harmonics tendency that the NFED had.
There is a capacitor in the 9-to-1 transformer. Isn't that doing that?
No, not at all. It has to be positioned in the middle of the NFED. The capacitor is simply a way of making your balun more efficient at a broader range of frequencies.
Question. Right, you're right. Could I do this with a variable capacitor?
You could, but it probably would be best to do it with something that wouldn't just kind of move, jiggle around, and change over time. So, you know, maybe something that adjusts with a screwdriver or such, but, you know, it depends what you mean by a variable capacitor. So theoretically, yeah, you could do that, or you could adjust it for the best kind of harmonics and then substitute it for a set capacitor, that fixed capacitor that won't move around much. But, yeah, theoretically, you could.
US2M.
Yeah, first Brian, then Paul.
Okay, I just want to make it quick. NFED half waves, don't they use an Unun versus a balun? I would think that if it uses a balun, that I wouldn't need a common mode choke. Am I incorrect?
No, you're not correct. You're correct that if you want to get technical about it, you're taking an unbalanced NFED half wave to a unbalanced coax. So technically, it's a 1-to-64 unun. But you'd still have to choke it later on. Because unless it's a very interesting unun, a lot of ununs don't really provide RF choking. So usually NFEDs require an RF choke at some point. Otherwise, they tend to get into people's houses and produce a lot of RFI interference.
Comment?
Yeah, sure.
WNW. I tried breaking in before. I just wanted to do a rewind on the antenna launcher. You're putting putty on a PVC leak on there. That throws a red flag up.
Okay.
I deal with this. I hope it's schedule 40 there. A lot of people say 15 pounds of pressure. That's a small number and stuff like that. It's not. That thing lets loose, that's a lot of pressure there. And if you look on my Whiskey 1 Whiskey Oscar Romeo, W1WR on my page, that's my antenna launcher that I have on there. And you had to put a tissue, whatever, for that bean bag that tree guys use to throw up there, to throw their wines up there. What happens is air is escaping around the bean bag. Same thing with a musket, you know. If it's not tight enough, air escapes around it, so I'd be a little cautious about that patching of that, and it's a leak in there. That thing lets loose on you. You know, you don't want to be around when that thing lets loose there, and I hope you're using Schedule 40.
Yes, it's definitely Schedule 40, and that's why I wrapped the pressurized tube tightly in dungarees and jeans. I'm showing my age when I say dungarees, but I wrapped it in jeans wrapped around the tube, the full length of the tube. The only thing that was showing was the Schrader valve. And like I said, I brought it up to actually 60 PSI, and it just worked fine. Nothing happened, nothing loosened, no end cap flew off. And there wasn't any more leakage of air around that ball valve.
Well, I don't know what kind of putty you're using, but that throws a red flag. If there's a leak in there, there's going to be a problem down the road with putty. So, like I said, my QRZ page has mine that has a pressure release on there. That thing will take 90 pounds of anything over that release. And I use no more than 40 pounds in that. And that's a tennis ball launcher. And I only put 40 pounds of that, and that will launch it way over 100 feet. So I just want to say, and would you turn around and go into brass to PVC, if fitting, if you're using Teflon tape to thread that that piece there into the unit there. So I'm just, you know, be cautious of that putty there. I don't know what your putty, that thing could let loose on there, W1WOR.
Full stand again.
Whiskey 1, Whiskey Oscar Romeo, W1WR, like 710 radio.
Thank you.
And that was done by a guy that put it in a pressure testing unit and everything. This thing is well built there. And I don't, you can lend it out to whatever you do, but the guy I bought it from, he says, do not lend this out. Because somebody bangs that thing around there, you're the next one to handle it. You hope things are all right with it. W1WOR.
Hey, CTPM.
Yeah, Jeff?
Yeah, Roy, you've been in the ER. Just because you cover something in denim doesn't mean that whatever's behind it is not carrying that denim 250 miles an hour straight into your thigh.
Yeah, unfortunately, this device is incredibly dangerous, and you could do a lot of harm. It was my understanding that the reason why, you know, people end up talking about how building their own is not to save a couple of bucks, but because in New York State, it's frowned upon as a weapon. So, you know, try and do things in a very safe manner, because you can't take them back.
My watch is tennis balls, 2 ounces, 4 ounces, 6 ounces, not a metal object like some people use on sinkers and stuff. That thing gets loose, and actually some people build them and they have a PVC shuttle, it's another piece of PVC pipe with caps on it filled with sand or whatever. That thing ever goes flying in another direction there, they're going to be responsible for whatever it hits.
Yeah, it's one of those things that doesn't look dangerous, I guess, to some people, but can be incredibly dangerous.
I'm the first responder. Leave the calls and stuff that I go for.
Yeah. Well, like I said before, yeah, just because you can put something together, just because you can do it, doesn't necessarily mean that you should. Just be very, very well aware of the risks that you take and the people nearby. It's risky to people who are just witnessing you that might be in the line of fire.
I read wear denim because it's doubled up, you know, the two legs of the pants. PVC, if it came apart, or if that Schrader valve came apart, it would be hard-pressed to come through both layers of the denim. Anyway, I worked it up slowly. I first did 20 PSI, then 25, you know, I worked it up to 50. And didn't even need 50, because when I shot the beanbag up without the spring attached, it had to go 80 feet in the air. It went very, very high. But with the string attached, it only went about 60 feet in the air. And I also doubled up on the glue on each joint. And what can I say? I'm still here to talk about it, and it worked flawlessly, and I would use it again if I had to. Go ahead.
And WSU, and I still want to make a quick comment.
Sure, Paul.
You asked about the bursting pressure of the pipe itself. You know, not the fittings attached or anything like that, but the pipe itself. we've had systems that go, that, you know, working pressure, like 300 PSI. I wouldn't be surprised if the bursting price, pressure of a pipe itself like that, probably three times that number, you know, probably 1,000 PSI. But, the fittings and how they're attached, that's a different story. But the pipe itself, as long as it's scheduled, 40, not 20. 20 is half the thickness. Not designed for something like that. You know, that's fine. Back to you, Richard.
Easy to peel.
Yeah, it was all definitely schedule 40.
Yes, Jeff?
Using denim as a protective coat, I would really rather just have to pick PVC out of my leg as opposed to pick contaminated, toxic other thread material out of my thigh or have someone at the ER do it. You're not actually protecting yourself at all, and it's not being done in a safe manner. Until you actually know what the failure point of that material is, you really don't know anything.
Well, if you think about it, the only thing that could explode is the components before the ball valve. And not afterwards. And, you know, there's a big brass ball valve, so I wasn't worried about that. And then there were a couple of coupling pieces between the ball valve and the PVC. And I would think, are you talking about, is the big worry that the PVC itself would shatter?
I'm not worried about anything. You should be worried about it. That's my point, is that you actually have drilled into a device to put the Schrader valve. You've drilled into a device to put the ball valve. You know, you've actually added a lot of weakening points. The glue is a weakening point. All of these people that are mentioning things, saying that you should do terminal testing in a very safe environment as opposed to just winging it. I think that's all everyone's trying to say. And no one's being critical. We're just encouraging you to be extraordinarily careful. That's all. AC2PL.
Like I said, you put putty on a leaking piece of PVC. There's a failure point right there.
I didn't drill anything. There's a coupling between the PVC, between the T coupler, you know, it looks like a T, and the Schrader valve with a reducer involved. That got away from having to drill into anything.
I feel safe with mine. I had a person who built it put in a pressure testing chamber and that tested everything to make sure the glue was everything right there. I don't bring that out in cold weather because the PVC turns around, gets cold and stuff, and the joints are stressed out there. So there's a lot of factors. I use that and I don't use that at times there. But I feel safe with this one. But putting putty on a leaking PVC pipe that you're putting pressure in, it throws a red flag. I'm sorry.
No, I understand your concern. But as I said, I stopped the leak and no other point on the whole launcher was leaking. So it was only that one little spot. Put some putty around that little spot, and that stopped that leak. And like I said, I did ratchet it up. I went from 10 pounds, shot it off, to 15 pounds, shot it off, and went up and up and up. And then I did a test without the string, just with the beanbag, and that's where the thing took off like 80 feet in the air and came down. The string attached to the beanbag, I feel I could have used a little more pressure, maybe 65 pounds of pressure, but I didn't want to go up that far. So, but no, I understand your concern, and I was cognizant of all the concerns, because I, believe me, I read up on this a lot before I put it together. And most people said that it would be hard-pressed for PVC, if it shattered, to go through four layers of denim. Because, you know, each pants leg has two layers of denim. So if you wrap two pants legs around the pressurized part of it, that's four layers of denim. That would take a pretty big explosion to go through that, I would think.
A 2x4 coming out of a tornado there, it can go through a foundation wall there, right through it there. So I'm just saying there, it will rip through stuff. Don't think that's not going to do it. All right, I said enough. WNWR.
I think we should add cautionary notes here not to do this at all, ever.
Oh, what was that? Was that directed at me?
I think Jeff gave a reasonable cautionary comment that it's a risky thing. People are willing to take their own risks. That's life in the big city. It's not something generally that people should kind of say, gee, this is a great idea. I think I'm going to do it next weekend.
Yeah, well, I was aware of the risk because I did a lot of research on it on the internet, and people have cautioned me against it before tonight, but none of the people that cautioned me against it ever had that I read on the internet, ever had with Schedule 40 an accident where the whole thing blew up. So that's why I went up by 5 pounds between each release of the air. I went up another 5 pounds, and worked out for me. Not that I'm going to shoot this thing off every day, only if I need put another wire up there. Go ahead. It's either that or be off the air.
Yeah, you could make a point that if something like that blew up on a person, he probably wouldn't be available to write his story on a web page. But, you know, everyone beware. We're not telling you to do it. We're not thinking you do it. Certainly no one here wants to be sued if something happens. So, you know, you take it for what it's worth. I think we've kind of kicked this dead horse as much as we're going to tonight. Okay, let's move on to the next person. Sam, what do you got for us tonight, Sam?
Hi, everybody. K2NE, can you improve the performance of a handheld 5-watt handheld 2-meter rig by attaching a different type of antenna to it other than the whip it usually comes with?
Sure. A lot of people do that. A lot of people, you know, especially if they buy some cheap HD from China, the first thing that they do is unscrew it, throw it away, get it something that's possibly from a diamond or a similar model. So, yeah, there are better whip antennas. There are longer whip antennas that can grab signals a little bit better. There's the option to have a counterpoise. HTs operate by using U as the counterpoise, but instead you could take a piece of wire and attach it to the shielding and provide a much better counterpoise. So there's a lot of different ways of improving performance of a handy talkie by either including a counterpoise or getting a higher quality antenna. So certainly.
One problem I'm having, of course, is my rig in my shack is connected to a diamond antenna outside and up about 40 feet. And if I use a handheld in my bedroom with the longer whip, I have problems. I can hit the repeater, but it comes across as noise. So the question is, how can I make my handheld work better in the bedroom? Where it depends on where I'm standing. Is there a way to deal with that type of issue?
Yeah, one of the famous lines of the technical net was that there's three important things about propagation of UHF and VHF signals, and that's elevation, and finally elevation. The higher you can mount your antenna, the better contact you're going to make with local repeaters. So, if there was one quality that would make it or break it, it would be elevating it. If you could go to the tallest structure in your house, that probably would give you a little bit better benefit than the first floor. Environment. Most houses are reasonably well shielded of weather and also to a degree electromagnetic waves. So it's sometimes a little bit better if you have a whip antenna to kind of place it really close to the window. Glass doesn't conduct electromagnetic waves, and so it'll kind of go right through the glass, and it's more beneficial than if you put your handy talkie in the middle of a room and you have to deal with the walls and what the walls are made of. So yeah, there are different types of environments that might give you a little bit of effort. The dramatic one, like I said before, is elevation. Even if you took the same whip and you elevated it to the top of your house, you would have a significant improvement in its ability.
Comment?
Sure.
WNWR again. Well, back in the CB days, and it's no difference than this, I seen people take magnetic antennas and put it on a cookie sheet somewhere near a window or on the refrigerator. Or I know somebody in Jersey who can get into this repeater, and he's got a magnetic antenna outside on his air conditioning unit, and the coax comes inside, and he's got an adapter to fit his HT, and he gets out great.
Yeah, I agree with you. I've tried all of those. It works to a degree, but, it depends. I mean, if you have something on a cookie pan that's, 10 feet off the ground, that's okay. Outside, better than inside. But still, it, the higher you can elevate it, the more significant the benefit you get. But, yeah, there's a lot of different ways. I don't think you'd get an incredibly different, ability to reach repeaters by just going from a whip to a magnet mount. It depends upon how long the whip is and where the magnet mount is located. Outside, preferable to inside. Something with a big channel, like an air conditioner. Like I said, I've tried all of those. They work to a degree. But, raise it two or three stories high, and it's amazing what it's capable of.
Does the length of the coax between the antenna and the handheld have an effect, or is that irrelevant?
Well, it sort of depends on how long your wire is and how skinny your wire is. For For very short distances, it doesn't make that much of a difference. You know, the amount of loss, for something that's a foot away is not much. But if there's a significant distance, the attenuation effect at UHF especially gets worse as you go up higher frequencies. So VHF has a degree of problems. UHF is much more problematic. So it's more a matter of, you know, if it's a foot or two, it's fine. If you're going to do it for, you know, 10, 20 feet, then it's going to add up.
All right. Thank you very much. It helps me a great deal. Good evening.
Thank you, Sam. Someone wanted to say something. We were doubling and tripling, I think, at one point.
Do I have one? Two STP.
Okay, Paul first, and then Chris.
Oh, okay. The double with Chris. Anyway, I have the smiling antenna for the, you know, two-minute HTs, which work. Mine has a BNC on it. But you can get them with a SMA telescopic antenna. It's good if you're sitting in the backyard and you're marginal into the repeater. You just want that little bit extra. It works very nice. If you're gonna walk around in the house with it, it's kind of ridiculous. It's gonna be banging into the ceiling every time you walk around. But it's great for outdoors and maybe at the park or something. Back to you.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I like BNCs. I find them the best to kind of remove and replace, and they have a nice this sturdy mount. If you start to play with SMBs and such, they're rather sad little connectors that you can snap them off the chassis very easy. But you really have to work hard to do it for a BNC. So I always get a BNC extension and cover up the SMA and use antennas that have the other side of the BNC connector. Just makes life a lot easier. Chris, what did you want to say?
Well, very easily. A good example for the gentleman's question. I am talking on a HT right now. I'm putting out 5 watts. I just looked at the setting. It has 3, 5, or 7. I can put it down to 3. It'll do the same thing. I'm 25 miles away from the repeater, and I'm connected to an antenna that goes up to my roof. It's just a little 3-foot scanner antenna, and because I'm sitting in my living room. I'm not in the shack, so sitting in the living room. I put a little adapter on my wall, filled a hole in the wall, ran a real cheap piece of coax up the rest of the side of the house and up to the little antenna, and hit the repeater and received perfectly fine. It's pretty easy.
Okay, what kind of a coax you got going up there? Is it a real skinny one or something in the middle?
Well, outside, I can't remember. It was probably just a cheap piece of old, either 58, that's the cable. I forgot the 8U or whatever. It's a thick one outside. That's about 40 feet long. But in the living room, I have a plate on the wall, so I have a 20-foot piece of really cheap, thin. This doesn't even have a label on it. It's absolutely nonsense. It's just got BNC on both sides, and I put BNC so I can walk around the living room a little bit or sit in different seating positions and just unfurl the cable when I'm using it like this. And but it makes no difference. It really, I can put any coax. I mean, you put 5 watts, like you said. If I'm losing 10%, okay, it's 4.5 watts or whatever. It really doesn't matter. You're not putting out much power.
Okay, but it's a good thing that your external coax is a regular thickness, so you're not going to get much attenuation out of that. You know, it's always good to have a little bit of spare room just in case you need it to hit a repeater. But, yeah, your configuration works fine. Like I said before, elevation, in my humble opinion, is probably the most important aspect for the average UHF, VHF guy. It'll make you or break you. I mean, you could play with linear amplifiers from today until next year, but if your antenna is, 3 feet off the ground, it's not going to get you very far.
Absolutely, Roy, and my antenna is pretty high. As you know, my house is on stilts, and 2.5-3 stories high, and it's up on the top roof, so it's almost 50 feet up in the air. That makes all the difference. Straight line to the repeater.
Yep, elevation, elevation, elevation.
I got it.
Okie doke, Sam. I hope it works out. I'm sure it will.
Excellent ideas given to me just now. Thank you.
You are quite welcome, Sam, and thank you for participating tonight. Brian, you're on our little list here. You got a question tonight?
Well, let's see. I'll tell you something. So many topics have been covered that I think I'm going to go ahead and pass the torch since I've given some commentary. So let's move on to the next. Thanks.
Okay, very well. Jeremy, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. KE2HQF.
Okay, what can I do you for tonight?
Well, I'm thinking sort of broad philosophical question of, there's a piece in the New York Times today about how many people are moving back towards various kinds of superstitions and the title of the piece is that we are sliding back into the Middle Ages, from an essay in the New York Times, and it talks about a lot of the this sort of hallucinatory thinking that's going on in the world nowadays with people. It seems like people are losing their grip on reality in the sense that, and of course this is, there's many ways to look at this, but I've been reading a bit about the science theory and testable propositions and that sort of thing, and how that's helped us move along in terms of science and technology since the Enlightenment. But we seem to be moving backwards, and AI doesn't appear to be helping much. It's helping people move into fantasy worlds more than it is helping people maintain a grip on reality in many cases. And I'm thinking about strategies to help help reverse this trend to some degree, and what can be done, and almost thinking, well, can we enlist the AI to help teach people to understand the epistemology, if you will, of science, which is difficult because it's based on doubt and it changes, and as we saw in the pandemic, people were very upset that science kept changing its position on should we wear masks or this dangerous or that, you know, the social distancing, and science seemed to not have a solid authority. And in fact, science is anti-authority in the sense that it's always challenging itself. And that's very difficult for people to understand because it's much easier to take an approach, well, this is the truth, and this is the authority, and this is a smart scientist who's saying this. But then, you know, someone else comes along and challenges that. But that's the way science is. And yet, it does help us move in a positive direction if we use it properly. But we seem to be backsliding, what with the influence of social media and AI. And I know this is a very broad question, but I'm interested in your thoughts about how to fight this battle.
AC2GS. I think ultimately with education and not with an artificial intelligence. Education because they're faulty and they hallucinate. The problem is that most people have very little foundation in the field of science itself. And when they do get some smattering of science, it's kind of pre-digested and very clean. I've repeatedly through the years on this technical net reminded people that science is a very messy thing. It's done by human beings, so it's sometimes irrational and sometimes egotistical. Scientists fight each other. Even though, you know, people are involved in the same discovery, they fight each other just because egos will be egos. And I think it requires more critical thinking on all of us. It's always been this way as far as I've read. You make advances, and then there are people going back to talking about ghosts and spirits. And, you know, you invent photography, and then some smart aleck discovers a way of double exposing angels on top of the negative and selling you a story that angels are hovering above you. So I think it will never be gone. We are, unfortunately, irrational in many ways. We distrust authority, and authority is not fundamentally absolute. Even scientists get things wrong. Sometimes they get little things wrong. Sometimes they, unfortunately, get big things wrong. But it's self-correcting. But, you know, once you've changed your mind based on experience and tests, you're lesser to some people who don't understand how messy science can be. You know, in some cases, masks are beneficial. In others, they generate mistrust and political complications. So, you know, health departments will kind of bear one way or the other. Is it worth the trouble? Does it save that many people? If it upsets a lot of people and causes them to mistrust authority and then they don't listen to you about anything. So, again, human beings are irrational, messy people. Science is the product of humanity, so it, too, is somewhat messy. Science history books will clean it up for you and give you a wrong idea. Almost no one recalls the fight that took place at the turn of the previous century between alternate current power supplies and direct current power supplies. And you know, there are, for that one example, there are 10,000 others. Unfortunately, I think we're stuck with our evolutionary development, and it's a never-ending battle between the irrational and the rational.
I certainly agree with all that, but since we started the evening talking about AI subjects, one of the points in this article is that AI can be used to manufacture evidence to support various kinds of bizarre takes on reality, and So it becomes, you know, it's a tool like anything else. It can be used in a positive way or a negative way. And it's just a new element in the challenge of this long battle that you refer to, with people backsliding into various forms of superstition or belief systems that do not really match up with reality. But AI is going to add some challenges to this, you know, as you talk about you know, deep fakes and things like that, that help people convince other people that their point of view is correct when, in fact, they're just using AI to create essentially an alternate reality of some kind. And so it's a new kind of challenge that I think that people need to be thinking about.
I agree with you. This is a deeply flawed tool at this point. The fact that, you know, 1 or 2 or 3% of all output is hallucination is very problematic. And also, once again, these large language models are not particularly designed to be truthful. They're designed to be agreeable. They're designed to be thought well of. You finish your experience with ChatGPT or a similar, and you feel that you had a good experience, not because they gave you the right answer, but usually because they agreed with your answer, that it was right, and everyone who's telling you it's wrong is a fool, and you're a brilliant person who people don't appreciate. And I have seen many sessions on the internet with somewhat arrogant people who believed everything their ChatGPT session was telling them, to the point of trying to make money off of other people by offering to share the prompts that they used that cracked open the AI to give the ultimate answer, truthful, correct answer. They were blissfully unaware that they were being played by an auto completion verbal model. So again, this is just another layer. You think of all the other mediums that have promoted ancient civilizations landing on Earth, building the pyramids. We've used radio, we've used television, we've used magazines, we use the printing press, all manner of technology. So why not use artificial intelligence and iPods and such? It's just, unfortunately, as society matures, as technology advances, people will figure out bad ways of using the technology in addition to the good ways. And we just have to train our population to have a better understanding of cool thinking and think things out. When I was a little kid, I took out books on numerology and astrology and alien civilizations, and thankfully I had enough of a fundamental in the subjects to kind of read them and say, this is complete nonsense. There are other people out there, if it's been published, I knew very nice people who would tell me that if they read something in the New York Times, it had to be true because it was the New York Times. Well, sometimes even the New York Times gets it completely wrong.
Yeah, the New York Times is far from perfect. I've been a subscriber for many years, and I could go into many, you know, critical episodes there for things that I've read about it. It read in the New York Times. However, when I consider that, you know, people are instead, you know, gathering their news from Facebook, I say to myself, I'll stick with the Times. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you have a better chance of getting it right. It's not 100%. There's no infallible source, again, because all of these things inherently derive from us human beings. Soon, unfortunately, AI might end up having their own publication. But, you know, anything that we read in the New York Times, for the most part, is written by a fallible human being. So, they can fail. You need foundational background in the important subjects, which, unfortunately, I don't think are being taught anymore. And you have to learn the ability to use those fundamentals to kind of function to see if the information you're receiving seems self-contradictory. I make it more simpler. I tell people that I have a decent BS meter. But ultimately, I think that's the difference between people who I know people who believe every single conspiracy theory, even though they are self-contradictory, they still believe them all. We used to have a very nice gentleman who would show up and he would tell people about Planet X and how New York City was going to be flooded underwater because of gravitational effects of Planet X is on the same distance from the sun, but on the other side of the solar system. And, yes, there's loads of people like that. There's a lot of people who believe in the flat Earth, you know, and there's nothing that you can do to deter that in them. You just have to kind of, you know, not talk to them about the subject or stay as far away from them as possible.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
Thank you, Roy. This is KD2VHT, Jim. Wide topic you're discussing. Wide. Let me narrow it down to a little point and for your consideration. 6 foot social distancing. 6 foot social distancing. The distance and the nomenclature completely contrived. It's been admitted that it has no basis in any science that's ever existed. And that alone, that one point alone, the damage it caused, is enough to put complete doubt in all science and all authority, or at least give it a very, very questioning look. So that might explain some of the why. Certainly a way bigger topic than that one little point. But for your consideration, back to that. Thank you, Roy.
Okay. I really don't want to have the COVID argument over again. I still remember guys emailing me that I had ruined the technical net by impugning ivermectin as a cure-all. And I understand ivermectin has made another reappearance. Now they're promoting it as a multi-cancer treatment. So COVID is respiratorily infectious. If you stand around a bunch of people coughing who have the virus, you can catch it as well. There are many, 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 many cases documented of people being exposed at gatherings and spread it as a massive event. So to just say that they were wrong without having any kind of documentation doesn't really get us anywhere.
They treated it like 6 foot was the magic number. And why on earth would you call it social distancing when if you were a scientist trying to stop germs from jumping from six feet or 5 feet or 8 feet, you would call it medical distancing or physical distancing. Why on earth would you call it social distancing? That's not how language works. It's weird. Fishy stuff, Joe. Fishy stuff. You can't discount that there was some funny business going on of some sort. Exactly what, we've yet to determine.
Comment.
Six. Okay, comment.
I think amateur radio operators handle the pandemic and being cooped up, the WNWR, I forgot, that we were able to handle because we were still able to talk to a large group of people every single day.